accurately our emotional reactions to future events, because it's difficult to imagine them as they will happen, and difficult to imagine how we'll think about them once they do. Throughout this book, I've compared imagination to perception and memory, and I've tried to convince you that foresight is just as fallible as eyesight and hindsight. Fallible eyesight can be remedied by glasses, and fallible hindsight can be remedied by written records of the past. But what of fallible foresight? There aren't any spectacles that can sharpen our view of tomorrow, and no records of things to come. Can we remedy the problems of foresight? As we're about to see, we can, but we generally choose not to. Part 6. Corrigibility. Capable of being corrected, reformed, or improved. Chapter 10. Once Bitten. Experience, O thou disproof'st report. Shakespeare. Cymbeline. The last decade has seen an explosion of books about poop. When my 2-year-old granddaughter crawls up on my lap, she typically brings with her a fat stack of picture books, including several that explore in considerable detail the miracle of defecation and the mysteries of indoor plumbing. Some offer detailed descriptions for the budding anatomist. Some offer little more than drawings of happy children squatting, standing, and wiping. Despite their many differences, each of these books communicates the same message. Grown-ups do not poop in their pants, but if you do, then don't worry too much about it. My granddaughter seems to find this message both reassuring and inspirational. She understands that there's a right way and a wrong way to poop, and that while we don't expect her to poop the right way just yet, we do want her to notice that most of the people around her have learned to poop the right way, which suggests that with a little practice and a little coaching, she can learn to poop the right way too. As it turns out, the benefits of practice and coaching aren't limited to this particular skill. In fact, practice and coaching are the two means by which we learn just about everything we know. First-hand knowledge and second-hand knowledge are the only two kinds of knowledge there are, and no matter what task we master, pooping, cooking, investing, bobsledding, that mastery is always a product of direct experience and/or of listening to those who have had direct experience. Babies poop in their diapers because they're rookies and because they can't take advantage of the lessons that veterans can provide. Because babies lack both first-hand knowledge and second-hand knowledge of proper potty protocol, we expect them to make a stinky mess, but we also expect that within a few years, practice and coaching will begin to have their remedial effects, innocence will yield to experience and education, and pooping errors will disappear altogether. So why doesn't this analysis extend to errors of every kind? We all have direct experience with things that do or don't make us happy. We all have friends, therapists, cab drivers, and talk show hosts who tell us about things that will or won't make us happy. And yet, despite all this practice and all this coaching, our search for happiness often culminates in a stinky mess. We expect the next car, the next house, or the next promotion to make us happy even though the last ones didn't, and even though others keep telling us that the next ones won't. Why don't we learn to avoid these mistakes in the same way that we learn to avoid warm diapers? If practice and coaching can teach us to keep our pants dry, then why can't they teach us to predict our emotional futures? The least likely of times. There are many good things about getting older, but no one knows what they are. We fall asleep and wake up at all the wrong times, avoid more foods than we can eat, and take pills to help us remember which other pills to take. In fact, the only really good thing about getting older is that people who still have all their hair are occasionally forced to stand back and admire our wealth of experience. They think of our experience as a form of wealth because they assume it allows us to avoid making the same mistake twice, and sometimes it does. There are a few experiences that those of us who are filthy rich with it just don't repeat, and bathing a cat while drinking peppermint schnapps comes to mind for reasons I'd rather not discuss right now. On the other hand, there are plenty of mistakes that we highly experienced folks seem to make over and over again. We marry people who are oddly like the people we divorced, we attend annual family gatherings and make an annual vow never to return, and we carefully time our monthly expenditures to ensure that we'll once again be flat broke on all the dates that begin with a 3. These cycles of recidivism seem difficult to explain. After all, shouldn't we learn from our own experience? Imagination has its shortcomings, to be sure, and it's perhaps inevitable that we'll mispredict how future events will make us feel when we've never experienced those events before. But once we've been married to a busy executive who spends more hours at work than at home, once we've attended a family reunion at which the aunts fight with the uncles who do their best to offend the cousins, and once we've spent a few lean days between paychecks acquiring intimate knowledge of rice and beans, shouldn't we be able to imagine these events with a reasonable degree of accuracy, and hence take steps to avoid them in the future? We should, and we do, but not as often or as well as you might expect. We try to repeat those experiences that we remember with pleasure and pride, and we try to avoid repeating those that we remember with embarrassment and regret. The trouble is that we often don't remember them correctly. Remembering an experience feels a lot like opening a drawer and retrieving a story that was filed away on the day it was written. But as we've seen in previous chapters, that feeling is one of our brain's most sophisticated illusions. Memory is not a dutiful scribe that keeps a complete transcript of our experiences, but a sophisticated editor that clips and saves key elements of an experience and then uses these elements to rewrite the story each time we ask to reread it. The clip-and-save method usually works pretty well because the editor usually has a keen sense of which elements are essential and which are disposable. That's why we remember how the groom looked when he kissed the bride, but not which finger the flower girl had up her nose when it happened. Alas, as keen as its editorial skills may be, memory does have a few quirks that cause it to misrepresent the past and hence causes us to misimagine the future. For example, you may or may not use four-letter words, but I trust you've never counted them. So take a guess. Are there more four-letter words in the English language that begin with K, let's call them K1s, or that have K as their third letter, let's call them K3s? If you're like most people, you guess that the K1s outnumber the K3s. You probably answered this question by briefly checking your memory. There's kite, kilt, kale. And because you found it easier to recall K1s than K3s, you assume there must be more of the former than the latter. This would normally be a very fine deduction. After all, you can recall more four-legged elephants than six-legged elephants because you've seen more four-legged elephants than six-legged elephants, and you've seen more four-legged elephants than six-legged elephants because there are more four-legged elephants than six-legged elephants. The actual number of four- and six-legged elephants in the world determines how frequently you encounter them, and the frequency of your encounters determines how easily you can remember those encounters. Alas, the reasoning that serves you so well when it comes to elephants serves you quite poorly when it comes to words. It's indeed easier to recall K1s than K3s, but not because you've encountered more of the former than the latter. Rather, it's easier to recall words that start with K because it's easier to recall any word by its first letter than by its third letter. Our mental dictionaries are organized more or less alphabetically, like Webster's itself. Hence, we can't easily look up a word in our memories by any letter except the first one. The fact is that there are many more K3s than K1s in the English language. But because the latter are easier to recall, people routinely get this question wrong. The K-word puzzle works because we naturally, but incorrectly, assume that things that come easily to mind are things we have frequently encountered. What's true of elephants and words is also true of experiences. Most of us can bring to mind memories of riding a bicycle more easily than we can bring to mind memories of riding a yak. Hence, we correctly conclude that we've ridden more bikes than yaks in the past. This would be impeccable logic, except for the fact that the frequency with which we had an experience isn't the only determinant of the ease with which we can remember it. In fact, infrequent or unusual experiences are often among the most memorable, which is why most Americans know precisely where they were on the morning of September 11, 2001, but not on the morning of September 10. The fact that infrequent experiences come so readily to mind can lead us to draw some peculiar conclusions. For instance, for most of my adult life, I've had the distinct impression that I tend to pick the slowest line at the grocery store, and that whenever I get tired of waiting in the slowest line and switch to another, the line I switched from begins moving faster than the one I switched to. Now, if this were true, if I really did have bad karma, bad juju, or some other metaphysical form of badness that caused any line I joined to slow down, then there would have to be someone out there who felt that they had a metaphysical form of goodness that caused any line they joined to to speed up. After all, everyone can't get in the slowest line on every occasion, can they? And yet, nobody I know feels that they have the power to quicken lines by joining them. On the contrary, just about everyone I know seems to believe that they, like me, are inexorably drawn to the slowest of all possible lines, and that their occasional attempts to thwart fate merely slow the lines they join and hasten the lines they abandon. Why do we all believe this? Because standing in a line that is moving at a rapid pace, or even an average pace, is such a mind-numbingly ordinary experience that we don't notice or remember it. Instead, we just stand there bored, glancing at the tabloids, contemplating the Clark bars, and wondering what idiot decided that batteries of different sizes should be labeled with different numbers of A's rather than with words we can actually remember, such as large, medium, and small. As we do this, we rarely turn to our partners and say, "Have you noticed how normally this line is moving? I mean, it's just so darned average that I'm feeling compelled to make notes so that I can charm others with the tale at a later date." No, the line-moving experiences we remember are those in which the guy in the bright red hat who was originally standing behind us before he switched to the other line has made it out of the store and into his car before we've even made it to the cash register because the bovine grandmother ahead of us is waving her coupons at the clerk and debating the true meaning of the phrase expiration date. This doesn't really happen that often, but because it's so memorable, we tend to think it does. The fact that the least likely experience is often the most likely memory can wreak havoc with our ability to predict future experiences. For example, in one study, researchers asked commuters waiting on a subway platform to imagine how they'd feel if they missed their train that day. Before making this prediction, some of the commuters were asked to remember and describe a time you missed your train. Other commuters were asked to remember and describe the worst time you missed your train. The results showed that commuters who were asked to remember an episode remembered an episode that was every bit as awful as the episode remembered by commuters who were asked to remember the worst episode. In other words, when commuters thought about train missing, the single most inconvenient and frustrating episodes tended to come to their minds. I could hear the train arriving, and so I started to run to catch it, but I tripped on the stairs and knocked over this guy who was selling umbrellas, and as a result, I was a half hour late for a job interview, and by the time I got there, they'd already hired someone else. Most instances of train missing are ordinary and forgettable, hence, when we think about train missing, we tend to remember the most extraordinary instances. Now, what does this have to do with predicting our emotional futures? K1 words come quickly to mind because of the way our mental dictionaries are organized and not because they're common. And memories of slow-moving grocery lines come quickly to mind because we pay special attention when we're stuck in them and not because they're common. But because we don't recognize the real reasons why these memories come quickly to mind, we mistakenly conclude that they are more common than they actually are. Similarly, awful train missing incidents come quickly to mind not because they're common, but because they're uncommon. But because we don't recognize the real reasons why these awful episodes come quickly to mind, we mistakenly conclude that they're more common than they actually are. And indeed, when commuters were asked to make predictions about how they would feel if they missed their train that day, they mistakenly expected the experience to be much more inconvenient and frustrating than it likely would have been. This tendency to recall and rely on unusual instances is one of the reasons why we so often repeat mistakes. When we think about last year's family vacation, we don't recruit a fair and representative sample of instances from our 2-week tour of Idaho. Instead, the memory that comes most naturally and quickly to mind is of that first Saturday afternoon when we took the kids horseback riding, crested the ridge on our Palominos, and found ourselves looking down into a magnificent valley, the river wending its way to the horizon like a mirrored ribbon as the sun played on its surface. The air was crisp, the woods were quiet. The kids suddenly stopped arguing and sat transfixed on their horses. Someone said, "Wow," in a very soft voice. Everyone smiled at everyone else, and the moment was forever crystallized as the high point of the vacation, which is why it instantly springs to mind. But if we rely on this memory as we plan our next vacation while overlooking the fact that the rest of the trip was generally disappointing, we risk finding ourselves at the same overcrowded campground the next year eating the same stale sandwiches, being bitten by the same surly ants, and wondering how we managed to learn so little from our previous visit. Because we tend to remember the best of times and the worst of times instead of the most likely of times, the wealth of experience that young people admire doesn't always pay clear dividends. All's well. I recently had an argument with my wife who insisted that I like the movie Schindler's List. Now, let me be clear. She wasn't insisting that I would like the film or that I should like the film. She was insisting that I do like the film, which we saw together in 1993. This struck me as supremely unfair. I don't get to be right about too many things, but the one thing I reserve the right to be right about is what I like. And as I've been telling everyone who would listen for more than a decade, I do not like Schindler's List. But my wife said I was wrong, and as a scientist, I feel morally bound to test any hypothesis that involves me eating popcorn. So we rented Schindler's List, watched it again, and the results of my experiment unequivocally proved who was right. We were. She was right because I was indeed riveted by the movie for all of the first 200 minutes. But I was right because at the end something awful happened. Rather than leaving me at the story's conclusion, the director, Steven Spielberg, added a final scene in which the real people on whom the characters were based came on screen and honored the movie's hero. I found that scene so intrusive, so mawkish, so thoroughly superfluous, that I actually said to my wife, "Oh, give me a break," which is apparently what I'd said in a rather loud voice to the entire theater in 1993. The first 98% of the movie was brilliant. The final 2% was stupid, and I remembered not liking the movie because, for me, it had ended badly. Now, the only strange thing about this memory is that I've sat through an awful lot of films whose proportion of brilliance was significantly less than 98%, and I remember liking some of them quite a bit. The difference is that in those films, the stupid parts were at the beginning, or in the middle, or somewhere other than the very end. So why do I like average films that end superbly more than nearly perfect films that end badly? After all, don't I get more minutes of intense and satisfying emotional involvement with the nearly perfect film than with the average film? Yes, but apparently that's not what matters. As we've seen, memory doesn't store a feature-length film of our experience, but instead stores an idiosyncratic synopsis. And among memory's idiosyncrasies is its obsession with final scenes. Whether we hear a series of sounds, read a series of letters, see a series of pictures, smell a series of odors, or meet a series of people, we show a pronounced tendency to recall the items at the end of the series far better than the items at the beginning or in the middle. As such, when we look back on the entire series, our impression is strongly influenced by its final items. This tendency is particularly acute when we look back on experiences of pleasure and pain. For instance, volunteers in one study were asked to use an electronic rating scale to report their moment-to-moment discomfort as they submerged their hands in icy water, which is a common laboratory task that's quite painful but that causes no harm. Every volunteer performed both a short trial and a long trial. On the short trial, the volunteers submerged their hand for 60 seconds in a water bath that was kept at a chilly 57 degrees Fahrenheit. On the long trial, volunteers submerged their hands for 90 seconds in a water bath that was kept at a chilly 57 degrees Fahrenheit for the first 60 seconds, then surreptitiously warmed to a not quite as chilly 59 degrees over the remaining 30 seconds. So the short trial consisted of 60 cold seconds, and the long trial consisted of the same 60 cold seconds with an additional 30 cool seconds. Which trial was more painful? Well, it depends on what we mean by painful. The long trial clearly comprised a greater number of painful moments, and indeed, the volunteers' moment-to-moment reports revealed that they experienced equal discomfort for the first 60 seconds on both trials, but much more discomfort in the next 30 seconds if they kept their hand in the water, as they did on the long trial, than if they removed it, as they did on the short trial. On the other hand, when volunteers were later asked to remember their experience and say which trial had been more painful, they tended to say that the short trial had been more painful than the long one. Although the long trial required the volunteers to endure 50% more seconds of immersion in ice water, it had a slightly warmer finish, and hence was remembered as the less painful of the two experiences. Memory's fetish for endings explains why women often remember childbirth as less painful than it actually was, and why couples whose relationships have gone sour remember that they were never really happy in the first place. As Shakespeare wrote, the setting sun and music at the close, as the last taste of sweets is sweetest last, writ in remembrance more than things long past. The fact that we often judge the pleasure of an experience by its ending can cause us to make some curious choices. For example, when the researchers who performed the cold water study asked the volunteers which of the two trials they would prefer to repeat, 69% of the volunteers chose to repeat the long one. That is, the one that entailed an extra 30 seconds of pain. Because the volunteers remembered the long trial as less painful than the short one, that was the one they chose to repeat. It would be easy to impugn the rationality of this choice. After all, the total pleasure of an experience is a function of both the quality and the quantity of the moments that constitute it, and these volunteers were clearly not considering quantity. But it would be just as easy to defend the rationality of this choice. We don't ride the mechanical bull or pose for a picture with a handsome movie star because these momentary experiences are inherently pleasurable. We do it so that we can spend the rest of our years immersed in blissful recollection. I stayed on for a full minute. If we can spend hours enjoying the memory of an experience that lasted just a few seconds, and if memories tend to overemphasize endings, then why not endure a little extra pain in order to have a memory that's a little less painful? Both of these positions are sensible, and you could sensibly hold either of them. The problem is that you more than likely hold both of them. Consider, for example, a study in which volunteers learned about a woman, whom we'll call Ms. Long, who had an utterly fabulous life until she was 60 years old, at which point her life went from utterly fabulous to merely satisfactory. Then at the age of 65, Ms. Long was killed in an auto accident. How good was her life? On a 9-point scale, volunteers said that Ms. Long's life was a 5.7. A second group of volunteers learned about a woman whom we'll call Ms. Short, who had an utterly fabulous life until she was killed in an auto accident at the age of 60. How good was her life? Volunteers said that Ms. Short's life was a 6.5. It appears, then, that these volunteers preferred a fabulous life to an equally fabulous life with a few additional merely satisfactory years. If you think about it for a moment, you'll realize that this is just how the volunteers in the ice water study were thinking. Ms. Long's life had more total pleasure than did Ms. Short's. Ms. Short's life had a better ending than Ms. Long's, and the volunteers were clearly more concerned with the quality of a life's ending than with the total quantity of pleasure the life contained. But wait a minute. When a third group of volunteers was asked to compare the two lives side by side, they showed no such preference. When the difference in the quantity of the two lives was made salient by asking volunteers to consider them simultaneously, the volunteers were no longer so sure that they preferred to live fast, die young, and leave a happy corpse. Apparently, the way an experience ends is more important to us than the total amount of pleasure we receive, until we think about it. The way we weren't. If you were an American of voting age on the evening of November 8, 1988, then you were probably at home watching the results of the presidential contest between Michael Dukakis and George Bush. When you think back on that election, you may recall the infamous Willie Horton ad, or the phrase, card-carrying member of the ACLU, or Lloyd Benson's stinging retort to Dan Quayle, "Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy." You most certainly recall that when all the votes were tallied, Americans decided not to send a Massachusetts liberal to the White House. Although Dukakis lost the election, he did win some of the more liberal states, and because we're talking about memory, I'd like to ask you to use yours right now. Close your eyes for a moment and try to remember exactly how you felt when the newscaster announced that Dukakis had won the state of California. Were you disappointed or delighted? Did you jump up and down or did you shake your head? Did you shed tears of joy or tears of sorrow? Did you say, "Thank God for the left coast," or "What do you expect of fruits and nuts?" If you inhabit the liberal end of the political spectrum, then you probably remember feeling happy when California was called. And if you live towards the conservative end, then you probably remember feeling less so. And if that's what you remember, then my friends and fellow citizens, I stand before you today to announce that your memory is mistaken. Because in 1988, Californians voted for George Herbert Walker Bush. Why is it so easy to pull a cheap stunt like this? Because memory is a reconstructive process that uses every piece of information at its disposal to build the mental images that come trippingly to mind when we engage in an act of remembering. One such piece of information is the fact that California is the liberal state that gave us transcendental meditation, granola, psychedelic rock, Governor Moonbeam, and Debbie Does Dallas. So it makes sense that Michael Dukakis, like Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and John Kerry, would have won the state handily. But before Californians began voting for Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and John Kerry, they voted as many times as they possibly could for Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Richard Nixon. Unless you're a political scientist, a CNN junkie, or a longtime Californian, you probably didn't remember that bit of historical polytrivia. Instead, you made a logical inference, namely, that because California is a liberal state and because Dukakis was a liberal candidate, Californians must have voted for him. Just as historians and paleontologists use both facts and theories to make guesses about past events, so did your brain use a fact, namely that Dukakis was a liberal, and a theory, namely that Californians are liberal, to make a guess about a past event, namely that Californians voted for Dukakis. Alas, because your theory was wrong, your guess was wrong too. Our brains use facts and theories to make guesses about past events, and so too do they use facts and theories to make guesses about past feelings. Because feelings don't leave behind the same kinds of facts that presidential elections and ancient civilizations do, our brains must rely even more heavily on theories to construct memories of how we once felt. When those theories are wrong, we end up misremembering our own emotions. Consider, for instance, how your theories about something, how about gender, might influence your recollection of past feelings. Most of us believe that men are less emotional than women. She cried, he didn't. That men and women have different emotional reactions to similar events. He was angry, she was sad. And that women are particularly prone to negative emotions at particular points in their menstrual cycles. She's a bit irritable today, if you know what I mean. As it turns out, there's little evidence for any of these beliefs, but that's not the point. The point is that these beliefs are theories that can influence how we remember our own emotions. Consider three studies. In the first study, volunteers were asked to remember how they had felt a few months earlier, and the male and female volunteers remembered feeling equally intense emotions. Another group of volunteers was asked to remember how they had felt a month earlier, but before doing so, they were asked to think a bit about gender. When volunteers were prompted to think about gender, female volunteers remembered feeling more intense emotion, and male volunteers remembered feeling less intense emotion. In the second study, male and female volunteers became members of teams and played a game against an opposing team. Some volunteers immediately reported the emotions they'd felt while playing the game, and others recalled their emotions a week later. Male and female volunteers didn't differ in the kinds of emotions they reported. But a week later, female volunteers recalled feeling more stereotypically feminine emotions, such as sympathy and guilt, and male volunteers recalled feeling more stereotypically masculine emotions, such as anger and pride. In the third study, female volunteers kept diaries and made daily ratings of their feelings for 4 to 6 weeks. These ratings revealed that women's emotions didn't vary with the phase of their menstrual cycles. However, when the women were later asked to reread the diary entry for a particular day and remember how they had been feeling, they remembered feeling more negative emotion on the days in which they were menstruating. It seems that our theories about how people of our gender usually feel can influence our memory of how we actually felt. Gender is but one of many theories that have this power to alter our memories. For instance, Asian culture doesn't emphasize the importance of personal happiness as much as European culture does, and thus Asian Americans believe that they are generally less happy than their European American counterparts. In one study, volunteers carried handheld computers everywhere they went for a week and recorded how they were feeling when the computer beeped at random intervals throughout the day. These reports showed that the Asian American volunteers were slightly happier than the European American volunteers. But when the volunteers were asked to remember how they had felt that week, the Asian American volunteers reported that they'd felt less happy and not more. In a study using similar methodology, Hispanic Americans and European Americans reported feeling pretty much the same during a particular week, but the Hispanic Americans remembered feeling happier than the European Americans did. Not all theories involve some immutable characteristic of persons, such as gender or culture. For example, Which students tend to score highest on an exam, those who worry about grades or those who don't? Well, as a college professor, I can tell you that my own theory is that students who are deeply concerned about their performance tend to study more and hence outscore their more lackadaisical classmates. Apparently, students have the same theory, because research shows that when students do well on an exam, they remember feeling more anxious before the exam than they actually felt. And when students do poorly on an exam, they remember feeling less anxious before the exam than they actually felt. We remember feeling as we believe we must have felt. The problem with this error of retrospection is that it can keep us from discovering our errors of prospection. Consider the case of the 2000 U.S. presidential election. Voters went to the polls on November 7, 2000, to decide whether George Bush or Al Gore would become the 43rd president of the United States. But it quickly became clear that the election was too close to call and that its outcome would take weeks to decide. The next day, November 8, researchers asked some voters to predict how happy they would be on the day the election was ultimately decided for or against their favored candidate. On December 13, Al Gore conceded to George Bush, and the next day, December 14, the researchers measured the actual happiness of the voters. 4 months later, in April 2001, the researchers contacted the voters again and asked them to recall how they had felt on December 14. The study revealed three things. First, on the day after the election, pro-Gore voters expected to be devastated and pro-Bush voters expected to be elated if George Bush was ultimately declared the winner. Second, when George Bush was ultimately declared the winner, pro-Gore voters were less devastated and pro-Bush voters were less elated than they had expected to be, a tendency you've seen before in other chapters. But third and most important, a few months after the election was decided, both groups of voters remembered feeling as they had expected to feel and not as they had actually felt. Apparently, prospections and retrospections can be in perfect agreement, despite the fact that neither accurately describes our actual experience. The theories that lead us to predict that an event will make us happy also lead us to remember that it did make us happy, thereby eliminating evidence of their own inaccuracy. This makes it unusually difficult for us to discover that our predictions were wrong. We overestimate how happy we'll be on our birthdays, we underestimate how happy we'll be on Monday mornings, and we make these mundane but erroneous predictions again and again, despite their regular disconfirmation. Our inability to recall how we really felt is one of the reasons why our wealth of experience so often turns out to be a poverty of riches. Onward. When people are asked to name the single object that they would try to save if their home caught fire, the most common answer, much to the chagrin of the family dog, is my photo album. We don't just treasure our memories, we are our memories. And yet, research reveals that a memory is less like a collection of photographs than it is like a collection of impressionist paintings rendered by an artist who takes considerable license with his subject. The more ambiguous the subject is, the more license the artist takes, and few subjects are more ambiguous than emotional experience. Our memory for emotional episodes is overly influenced by unusual instances, closing moments, in theories about how we must have felt way back then, all of which gravely compromise our ability to learn from our own experience. Practice, it seems, doesn't always make perfect. But if you think back to all that talk about pooping, you'll remember that practice is just one of the two ways in which we learn. If practice doesn't fix us, then what about coaching? Chapter 11. Reporting live from tomorrow. Instructed by the antiquary times, he must, he is, he cannot but be wise. Shakespeare, Troilus and Cressida. In Alfred Hitchcock's 1956 remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much, Doris Day sang a waltz whose final version went like this. When I was just a child in school, I asked my teacher, what will I try? Should I paint pictures? Should I sing songs? This was her wise reply. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. Now, I don't mean to quibble with the lyricist, and I have nothing but fond memories of Doris Day, but the fact is that this is not a particularly wise reply. When a child asks for advice about which of two activities to pursue, A teacher should be able to provide more than a musical cliché. Yes, of course the future's hard to see, but we're all heading that way anyhow, and as difficult as it may be to envision, we have to make some decisions about which futures to aim for and which to avoid. If we're prone to mistakes when we try to imagine the future, then how should we decide what to do? Even a child knows the answer to that one. We should ask the teacher. One of the benefits of being a social and linguistic animal is that we can capitalize on the experience of others, rather than trying to figure everything out for ourselves. For millions of years, human beings have conquered their ignorance by dividing the labor of discovery and then communicating their discoveries to one another, which is why the average newspaper boy in Pittsburgh knows more about the universe than did Galileo, Aristotle, Leonardo, or any of those other guys who were so smart they only needed one name. We all make ample use of this resource. If you were to write down everything you know, and then go back through the list and make a check mark next to the things you know only because somebody told you, you'd develop a repetitive motion disorder, because almost everything you know is secondhand. Was Yuri Gagarin the first man in space? Is croissant a French word? Are there more Chinese than North Dakotans? Does a stitch in time save nine? Most of us know the answers to these questions, despite the fact that none of us actually witnessed the launching of Vostok 1, personally supervised the evolution of language, hand-counted all the people in Beijing and Bismarck, or performed a fully randomized double-blind study of stitching. We know the answers because someone shared them with us. Communication is a kind of vicarious observation that allows us to learn about the world without ever leaving the comfort of our barca loungers. The 6 billion interconnected people who cover the surface of our planet constitute a leviathan with 12 billion eyes, and anything that's seen by one pair of eyes can potentially be known to the entire beast in a matter of months, days, or even minutes. The fact that we can communicate with one another about our experiences should provide a simple solution to the core problem with which this book has been concerned. Yes, our ability to imagine our future emotions is flawed. But that's okay, because we don't have to imagine what it would feel like to marry a lawyer, move to Texas, or eat a snail when there are so many people who have done these things and are all too happy to tell us about them. Teachers, neighbors, co-workers, parents, friends, lovers, children, uncles, cousins, coaches, cab drivers, bartenders, hairstylists, dentists, advertisers, each of these folks has something to say about what it would be like to live in this future rather than that one. And at any point in time, we can be fairly sure that one of these folks has actually had the experience that we're merely contemplating. Because we are the mammal that shows and tells, each of us has access to information about almost any experience we can possibly imagine, and many that we can't. Guidance counselors tell us about the best careers, critics tell us about the best restaurants, travel agents tell us about the best vacations, and friends tell us about the best travel agents. Every one of us is surrounded by a platoon of Dear Abbeys who can recount their own experiences and, in so doing, tell us which futures are most worth wanting. Given the overabundance of consultants, role models, gurus, mentors, yentas, and nosy relatives, we might expect people to do quite well when it comes to making life's most important decisions, such as where to live, where to work, and whom to marry. And yet, the average American moves more than 6 times, changes jobs more than 10 times, and marries more than once, which suggests that most of us are making more than a few poor choices. If humanity is a living library of information about what it feels like to do just about anything that can be done, then why do the people with the library cards make so many bad decisions? There are just 2 possibilities. The first is that a lot of the advice we receive from others is bad advice that we foolishly accept. The second is that a lot of the advice we receive from others is good advice that we foolishly reject. So, which is it? Do we listen too well when others speak, or do we not listen well enough? As we'll see, the answer to that question is yes. Super replicators. The philosopher Bertrand Russell once claimed that believing is the most mental thing we do. Perhaps, but it's also the most social thing we do. Just as we pass along our genes in an effort to create people whose faces look like ours, so too do we pass along our beliefs in an effort to create people whose minds think like ours. Almost any time we tell anyone anything, we're attempting to change the way their brains operate, attempting to change the way they see the world so that their view of it more closely resembles our own. Just about every assertion from the sublime, God has a plan for you, to the mundane, turn left of the light, go 2 miles, and you'll see the Dunkin' Donuts on your right, is meant to bring the listener's beliefs about the world into harmony with the speaker's. Sometimes these attempts succeed and sometimes they fail. So what determines whether a belief will be successfully transmitted from one mind to another? The principles that explain why some genes are transmitted more successfully than others also explain why some beliefs are transmitted more successfully than others. Evolutionary biology teaches us that any gene that promotes its own means of transmission will be represented in increasing proportions in the population over time. For instance, imagine that a single gene were responsible for the complex development of the neural circuitry that makes orgasms feel so good. For a person having this gene, orgasms would feel, well, orgasmic. For a person lacking this gene, orgasms would feel more like sneezes, brief, noisy, physical convulsions that pay rather paltry hedonic dividends. Now, if we took 50 healthy, fertile people who had the gene, and 50 healthy, fertile people who didn't, and left them on a hospitable planet for a million years or so, when we returned, we'd probably find a population of thousands or millions of people, almost all of whom had the gene. Why? Because a gene that made orgasms feel good would tend to be transmitted from generation to generation simply because people who enjoy orgasms are inclined to do the thing that transmits their genes. The logic is so circular that it's virtually inescapable. Genes tend to be transmitted when they make us do the things that transmit genes. What's more, even bad genes, those that make us prone to cancer or heart disease, can become super replicators if they compensate for these costs by promoting their own means of transmission. For instance, if the gene that made orgasms feel delicious also left us prone to arthritis and tooth decay, that gene might still be represented in increasing proportions because arthritic, toothless people who love orgasms are more likely to have children than are limber, toothy people who don't. The same logic can explain the transmission of beliefs. If a particular belief has some property that facilitates its own transmission, then that belief tends to be held by an increasing number of minds. As it turns out, there are several such properties that increase a belief's transmissional success, the most obvious of which is accuracy. When someone tells us where to find a parking space downtown or how to bake a cake at high altitude, we adopt that belief and pass it along because it helps us and our friends do the things we want to do, such as parking and baking. As one philosopher noted, the faculty of communication would not gain ground in evolution unless it was by and large the faculty of transmitting true beliefs. Accurate beliefs give us power, which makes it easy to understand why they're so readily transmitted from one mind to another. It's a bit more difficult to understand why inaccurate beliefs are so readily transmitted from one mind to another, but they are. False beliefs, like bad genes, can and do become super replicators, and a thought experiment illustrates how this can happen. Imagine a game that's played between two teams, each of which has 1,000 players, each of whom is linked to teammates by a telephone. The object of the game is to get one's team to share as many accurate beliefs as possible. When players receive a message that they believe to be accurate, they call a teammate and pass it along. When they receive a message that they believe to be inaccurate, they don't. At the end of the game, the referee blows a whistle and awards each team a point for every accurate belief that the entire team shares and subtracts one point for every inaccurate belief the entire team shares. Now, consider a contest played one sunny day between a team called the Perfects, whose members always transmit accurate beliefs, and a team called the Imperfects, whose members occasionally transmit an inaccurate belief. We should expect the Perfects to win, right? Not necessarily. In fact, there are some special circumstances under which the Imperfects will beat their pants off. For example, imagine what would happen if one of the imperfect players sent the false message, "Talking on the phone all day and night will ultimately make you very happy." And imagine that other imperfect players were gullible enough to believe it and pass it on. This message is inaccurate, and thus will cost the imperfects a point in the end. But it may have the compensatory effect of keeping more of the imperfects on the telephone for more of the time, thus increasing the total number of accurate messages they transmit. Under the right circumstances, the costs of this inaccurate belief would be outweighed by its benefits, namely, that it led players to behave in ways that increased the odds that they would share other accurate beliefs. The lesson to be learned from this game is that inaccurate beliefs can prevail in the belief transmission game if they somehow facilitate their own means of transmission. In this case, the means of transmission isn't sex, but communication. And thus, any belief, even a false belief, that increases communication has a good chance of being transmitted over and over again. False beliefs that happen to promote stable societies tend to propagate because people who hold these beliefs tend to live in stable societies which provide the means by which false beliefs propagate. Some of our cultural wisdom about happiness looks suspiciously like a super-replicating false belief. Consider money. If you've ever tried to sell anything, then you probably tried to sell it for as much as you possibly could, and other people probably tried to buy it for as little as they possibly could. All the parties involved in the transaction assume that they'd be better off if they ended up with more money rather than less, and this assumption is the bedrock of our economic behavior. Yet, it has far fewer scientific facts to substantiate it than you might expect. Economists and psychologists have spent decades studying the relation between wealth and happiness, and they've generally concluded that wealth increases human happiness when it lifts people out of abject poverty and into the middle class, but that it does little to increase happiness thereafter. Americans who earn $50,000 per year are much happier than those who earn $10,000 per year. But Americans who earn $5 million per year are not much happier than those who earn $100,000 per year. People who live in poor nations are much less happy than people who live in moderately wealthy nations. But people who live in moderately wealthy nations are not much less happy than people who live in extremely wealthy nations. Economists explain that wealth has declining marginal utility, which is a fancy way of saying that it hurts to be hungry, cold, sick, tired, and scared, but once you've bought your way out of these burdens, the rest of your money is an increasingly useless pile of paper. So once we've earned as much money as we can actually enjoy, we quit working and enjoy it, right? Wrong. People in wealthy countries generally work long and hard to earn more money than they can ever derive pleasure from. This fact puzzles us less than it should. After all, a rat can be motivated to run through a maze that has a cheesy reward at its end, but once the little guy is all topped up, then even the finest Stilton won't get him off his haunches. Once we've eaten our fill of pancakes, more pancakes are not rewarding, hence we stop trying to procure and consume them. But not so, it seems, with money. As Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, wrote in 1776, "The desire for food is limited in every man by the narrow capacity of the human stomach, but the desire of the conveniences and ornaments of building, dress, equipage, and household furniture seems to have no limit or certain boundary." If food and money both stop pleasing us once we've had enough of them, then why do we continue to stuff our pockets when we wouldn't continue to stuff our faces? Adam Smith had an answer. He began by acknowledging what most of us suspect anyway, which is that the production of wealth is not necessarily a source of personal happiness. He wrote, "In what constitutes the real happiness of human life, the poor are in no respect inferior to those who would seem so much above them. In ease of body and peace of mind, all the different ranks of life are nearly upon a level, and the beggar who suns himself by the side of the highway possesses that security which kings are fighting for." That sounds lovely, but if it's true, then we're all in big trouble. If rich kings are no happier than poor beggars, then why should poor beggars stop sunning themselves by the roadside and work to become rich kings? If no one wants to be rich, then we have a significant economic problem, because flourishing economies require that people continually procure and consume one another's goods and services. Market economies require that we all have an insatiable hunger for stuff. And if everyone were content with the stuff they had, then the economy would grind to a halt. But if this is a significant economic problem, it's not a significant personal problem. The chair of the Federal Reserve may wake up every morning with a desire to do what the economy wants, but most of us get up with a desire to do what we want, which is to say, the fundamental needs of a vibrant economy and the fundamental needs of a happy individual are not necessarily the same. So what motivates people to work hard every day to do things that will satisfy the economy's needs but not their own? Like so many thinkers, Smith believed that people want just one thing, happiness. Hence, economies can blossom and grow only if people are deluded into believing that the production of wealth will make them happy. If and only if people hold this false belief will they do enough producing, procuring, and consuming to sustain their economies. Smith went on to write, "The pleasures of wealth and greatness strike the imagination as something grand and beautiful and noble, of which the attainment is well worth all the toil and anxiety which we are so apt to bestow upon it. It is this deception which rouses and keeps in continual motion the industry of mankind. It is this which first prompted them to cultivate the ground, to build houses, to found cities and commonwealths, and to invent and improve all the sciences and arts which ennoble and embellish human life, which have entirely changed the whole face of the globe, have turned the rude forests of nature into agreeable and fertile plains, and made the trackless and barren ocean a new fund of subsistence and the great high road of communication to the different nations of the earth. In short, the production of wealth doesn't necessarily make individuals happy, but it does serve the needs of an economy, which serves the needs of a stable society, which serves as a network for the propagation of delusional beliefs about happiness and wealth. Economies thrive when individuals strive, but because individuals will only strive for their own happiness, it's essential that they mistakenly believe that producing and consuming are routes to personal well-being. Although words such as delusional may seem to suggest some sort of shadowy conspiracy orchestrated by a small group of men in dark suits, the belief transmission game teaches us that the propagation of false beliefs doesn't require that anyone be trying to perpetrate a magnificent fraud on an innocent populace. There's no cabal at the top, no star chamber, no master manipulator whose clever program of indoctrination and propaganda has duped us all into believing that money can buy us love. Rather, this particular false belief is a super replicator because holding it causes us to engage in the very activities that perpetuate it. The belief transmission game explains why we believe some things about happiness that simply aren't true. The joy of money is one example. The joy of children is another that for most of us hits a bit closer to home. Every human culture tells its members that having children will make them happy. When people think about their offspring, either imagining future offspring or thinking about their current ones, they tend to conjure up images of cooing babies smiling from their bassinets, adorable toddlers running higgledy-piggledy across the lawn, handsome boys and gorgeous girls playing trumpets and tubas in the school marching band, successful college students going on to have beautiful weddings, satisfying careers, and flawless grandchildren whose affections can be purchased with candy. Prospective parents know that diapers will need changing, that homework will need doing, and that orthodontists will go to Aruba on their life savings. But by and large, they think quite happily about parenthood, which is why most of them eventually leap into it. When parents look back on parenthood, they remember feeling what those who are looking forward to it expect to feel. Few of us are immune to these cheery contemplations. I have a 29-year-old son, and I'm absolutely convinced that he is and always has been one of the greatest sources of joy in my life, having only recently been eclipsed by my 2-year-old granddaughter, who's equally adorable but who hasn't yet asked me to walk behind her and pretend we're unrelated. When people are asked to identify their sources of joy, they do just what I do. They point to their kids. Yet, if we measure the actual satisfaction of people who have children, a very different story emerges. Numerous studies have shown that couples generally start out quite happy in their marriages and then become progressively less satisfied over the course of their lives together, returning close to their original levels of satisfaction only when their children leave home. Despite what we read in the popular press, the only known symptom of empty nest syndrome is increased smiling. Interestingly, this pattern of satisfaction over the life cycle describes women, who are usually the primary caretakers of children, better than men. Careful studies of how women feel as they go about their daily activities show that they're less happy when taking care of their children than when eating, exercising, shopping, napping, or watching television. Indeed, looking after the kids appears to be only slightly more pleasant than doing housework. None of this should surprise us. Every parent knows that children are a lot of work, a lot of really hard work. And although parenting has many rewarding moments, the vast majority of its moments involve dull and selfless service to people who will take decades to become even begrudgingly grateful for what we're doing. If parenting is such a difficult business, then why do we have such a rosy view of it? One reason is that we've been talking on the phone all day with society's stockholders, our moms and uncles and personal trainers, who've been transmitting to us an idea that they believe to be true, but whose accuracy is not the cause of its successful transmission. Children bring happiness is a super replicator. The belief transmission network of which we are a part can't operate without a continuously replenished supply of people to do the transmitting. Thus, the belief that children are a source of happiness becomes a part of our cultural wisdom, simply because the opposite belief unravels the fabric of any society that holds it. Indeed, people who believe that children bring misery and despair and who thus stopped having them would put their belief transmission network out of business in around 50 years, hence terminating the belief that terminated them. The Shakers were a utopian farming community that arose in the 1800s and at one time numbered about 6,000. They approved of children, but they didn't approve of the natural act that creates them. Over the years, their strict belief in the importance of celibacy caused their network to contract, and today there are just a few elderly Shakers left, transmitting their doomsday belief to no one but themselves. The belief transmission game is rigged so that we must believe that children and money bring happiness, regardless of whether such beliefs are true. This doesn't mean that we should all now quit our jobs and abandon our families. Rather, it means that while we believe we're raising children and earning paychecks to increase our share of happiness, we're actually doing these things for reasons beyond our ken. We are nodes in a social network that arises and falls by a logic of its own, which is why we continue to toil, continue to mate, and continue to be surprised when we don't experience all the joy we so gullibly anticipated. The myth of fingerprints. My friends tell me that I have a tendency to point out problems without offering solutions, but they never tell me what I should do about it. In one chapter after another, I have described the ways in which imagination fails to provide us with accurate previews of our emotional futures. I've claimed that when we imagine our futures, we tend to fill in, leave out, and take little account of how differently we'll think about the future once we actually get there. I've claimed that neither personal experience nor cultural wisdom compensates for imagination's shortcomings. I've so thoroughly marinated you in the foibles, biases, errors, and mistakes of the human mind that you may wonder how anyone ever manages to make toast without buttering their kneecaps. If so, you'll be heartened to learn that there is a simple method by which anyone can make strikingly accurate predictions about how they'll feel in the future. But you may be disheartened to learn that, by and large, no one wants to use it. Why do we rely on our imaginations in the first place? Imagination is the poor man's wormhole. We can't do what we'd really like to do, namely travel through time, pay a visit to our future selves, and see how happy those selves are, and so we imagine the future instead of actually going there. But if we can't travel in the dimension of time, we can travel in the dimensions of space, and the chances are pretty good that somewhere in those other three dimensions there's another human being who is actually experiencing the future event that we are merely thinking about. Surely we aren't the first people ever to consider a move to Cincinnati, a career in motel management, another helping of rhubarb pie, or an extramarital affair. And for the most part, those who've already tried these things are more than willing to tell us about them. It's true that when people tell us about their past experiences, memory's peccadilloes may render their testimony unreliable. But it's also true that when people tell us about their current experiences, they're providing us with the kind of report about their subjective state that's considered the gold standard of happiness measures. If you believe, as I do, that people can generally say how they're feeling at the moment they're asked, then one way to make predictions about our own emotional futures is to find someone who's having the experience we're contemplating and ask them how they feel. Instead of remembering our past experience in order to simulate our future experience, perhaps we should simply ask other people to introspect on their inner states. Perhaps we should give up on remembering and imagining entirely and use other people as surrogates for our future selves. This idea sounds all too simple, and I suspect you have an objection to it that goes something like this. Yes, other people are probably right now experiencing the very things I am merely contemplating, but I can't use other people's experiences as proxies for my own because those other people aren't me. Every human being's as unique as his or her fingerprint, so it won't help me much to learn about how others feel in the situations that I'm facing. Unless these other people are my clones and have had all the same experiences I've had, their reactions and my reactions are bound to differ. I'm a walking, talking idiosyncrasy, and thus I'm better off basing my predictions on my somewhat fickle imagination than on the reports of people whose preferences, tastes, and emotional proclivities are so radically different from my own. Well, if that's your objection, it's a good one. So good that it will take two steps to dismantle it. First, let me prove to you that the experiences of a single, randomly selected individual can sometimes provide a better basis for predicting your future experience than your own imagination can. And then let me show you why you and I find this so difficult to believe. Finding the solution. Imagination has three shortcomings, and if you didn't know that, then you may be reading this book backward. If you did know that, then you also know that imagination's first shortcoming is its tendency to fill in and leave out without telling us, which we explored in the section on realism.